Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. And that starts with an open internet.
President-elect Barack Obama speaking at Google in Mountain View, California, back in November of 2007. Now everyone's waiting to see who he will choose for the coveted cabinet positions. But no one is more excited than tech nerds. Barack Obama has promised to create the first ever chief technology officer, bringing those Silicon Valley types into the fold of federal government in a big way for the first time. Here to discuss who that might be and what they should do is Andrew Roche, the founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, co-founder of Tech President, and pioneer in promoting the intersection of politics and technology, really. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here.
And, you know, we really got people in the mood for your appearance by asking last hour what folks do while they're waiting for their computers to boot up. And those are still coming in fast and furious. So I just want to acknowledge everybody who's posting on Twitter. You can sign up to follow us on Twitter. By the way, it's Brian Lehrer, one word. And somebody on Twitter wrote, "I sip my coffee and make my list of to-dos for the day while I'm waiting for my computer to boot." And Karen from Manhattan, Andrew, this woman, I think, either needs a new computer or she has too many teenagers. It says, "While my computer's booting up, I load the dishwasher, fold my laundry, do the New York Times crossword puzzle, and play with the dog." So, I don't know. That woman either needs a Mac or to reload her operating system or maybe to have fewer kids. I don't know.
You know, but it's a great metaphor for what we actually need to do with our government,
really,
which is to reboot it as well and to get it operating on a 21st century basis and as quickly as possible.
And that's the language that you usually use. You say we need to reboot our government. So what would a chief technology officer do? Would it be kind of like a secretary of the internet?
Well, you know, first I think it's important to point out that that the effectiveness of such a person really depends on where they sit in the hierarchy of the federal government. I mean, it'd be one thing if the CTO was a special assistant to the president and was able to actually sit in on all cabinet meetings and then at the president's behest make sure that his directives were carried out through every single federal agency to make them open and transparent using the most efficient technologies and trying to save money as well as provide, you know, services in a more efficient and 21st century way, as opposed to having this particular role sitting, you know, several layers down, maybe in the Office of Management and Budget, where, you know, they're going to be constantly writing memos hoping that the higher-ups are going to approve, which would probably delegate them to a less influential role. I mean, if you think about it, it's, you know, how significant this is. Imagine the chief technology officer for the steam engine looking for a job and being put at a desk at the Horse Trading Association.
Right. So in 2002, along these lines, Congress passed the E-Government Act to promote greater use of internet-based information technology throughout the federal government. That law created an Office of E-Government within the Office of Management and Budget. That fund just had $150 million for 2006. Which is nothing. So what can the e-government office claim as major accomplishments since 2002? Anything really?
Not really. I mean, there's certainly more information online, and every federal agency now has a website, but, you know, they're really Web 1.0, not Web 2.0. As a matter of fact, federal agencies aren't allowed to embed YouTube videos on their sites because California YouTube is a California company, Google, and as a California terms of service, and federal regulations prevent a federal agency from being subservient to a state law. So YouTube videos are not embeddable on federal sites.
Oh. So it's not only technological Web 1.0, but in kind of the democracy sense, Web 1.0 is much more top-down. The whole definition of Web 2.0 is that it's so user-generated.
Absolutely, and we've learned through this campaign is that citizens want to participate, not just in democracy, but in civic life. And they want to be able to talk back, and they are able to organize themselves and actually do things sometimes better than the government itself can do. As a matter of fact, a great example of that was just in this past election, we and a number of other partners, Rock the Vote and others, put together something called Twitter Vote Report, where tens of thousands of Americans were Twittering their from their voting locations, basically doing poll monitoring that you would normally think that government officials would be responsible for.
Right. We were part of that on Election Day. That was so exciting.
So that's an example of how people can actually use this technology and do these things themselves without waiting for government to happen. But again, back to the role of the CTO, it's important that this person really look across the entire federal bureaucracy and develop methodologies in order to upgrade all the procedures, regulations, rules, you name it, on a 21st century platform.
So it's and it's very much an open government kind of function as you're describing it. And you may know there's an active debate going on within the tech community. There's that website, ObamaCTO.org, which just went live on Tuesday and allows people to sign in and suggest what the priority for the chief technology officer should be and then vote on the other suggestions. So folks, if you want to do that, it's ObamaCTO for chief technology officer.org, ObamaCTO.org. And as of right now, the top priority based on the popular vote, we checked it just before the show, is, quote, to ensure the internet is widely accessible and network neutral, with 5,379 votes. Second is ensure our privacy and repeal the Patriot Act. Also in the top 10 are things like kickstart research and innovation and energy. So where do you come down on that?
I couldn't agree more that making sure that the internet is widely available and network neutral is a key piece of the puzzle, because it actually acts as the facilitator for so many of the other things that need to be done.
And network neutral, in shorthand, we've done shows on this, but for people who don't know, means not allowing your internet service provider to provide different websites at different loading speeds based on a fee that they pay or anything like that, right?
Correct.
By the way, this conversation broke out during our reboot segment that I wonder if you have an opinion on energy efficiency, because I was saying to people who just leave it on all night, for shame, and a lot of people have reacted negatively to that and said, like, here's a post that just came in. It said, it would be shameful for me not to leave it on all night. Why? At standby power, the PC consumes perhaps 20 watts over 10 hours. This is 0.2, or that's 20 watts. That's over 10 hours. This is 0.2 kilowatt hours, which costs about 4 cents. Even if a proper carbon tax would double this to 8 cents, I consider 2 minutes of my time to be worth rather more than 8 cents. Who of your listeners does not consider his or her time to be worth more than 8 cents? The focus on saving energy, regardless of its human cost, sounds noble, but it is misguided and the opposite of humane. Have you thought about this question?
Well, I think it's a question that everyone has to be asking themselves, which is really, what is your carbon footprint, and how, you know, not just looking at individual steps like just changing your light bulbs to fluorescent or worrying about whether or not your computer's using the right amount of power or not, but actually measuring all your behaviors. And there's actually some really terrific technologies now on the web that allow people to measure their entire carbon footprint. The one that comes to mind first is WattsOn, WattsOn.com, where you can really get into very specific analysis of every single part of your human behavior in your life and measure it so that you can understand how to reduce your carbon footprint, so that maybe if you're not driving as much, you won't feel so guilty if you've left your laptop on. It really needs to be looked at holistically as opposed to individually on individual items.
Interesting. We can take calls for Andrew Richey as well as comments online as we talk about President Obama's promise to appoint a chief technology officer for the first time in the federal government. 212-433-WNYC. What do you think the priority should be? 212-433-9692. And, of course, we have our Obama Fab Cab posting page still up at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can suggest somebody who should be the CTO. 212-433-WNYC if you want to talk about this on the air with Andrew Richey. And you have a great line that we've seen you use I think other e-government advocates say something like this, that the best designed government websites today are used to collect our taxes, while the worst designed sites are those that explain how our taxes are used.
Then why is that? Because our elected officials, I think, have designed it in that way so that they can make sure that they stay in positions of power, because they don't really want us to know what they do all day.
Right. And President-elect Obama has promised increased government transparency, and presumably the CTO would be instrumental in that effort. How would you do it if you were a CTO?
Well, first of all, I'm not qualified. You know, I'm happy being a diagnostician, but not the surgeon. And
really, with all you do, I would think of you as somebody potentially qualified for this position, with as much of a pioneer as you have been, seriously, in the intersection between technology and democracy.
Brian, it's very flattering, but really this person needs to be someone who has a full-scale history of being involved in the tech industry as an engineer, as a manager, as an running several enterprises. I'm thinking of people like Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, even though he said that he's not able to do the job or not interested. It's people of a caliber that have a very broad set of experiences in enterprises that can really look at this and think about how to solve the problem of converting the U.S. federal bureaucracy into a 21st century one, based on having done so with other industries that have now made the conversions. For example, as you well know, the entertainment industry is slowly now making a conversion to the digital age, and the energy industry is about to go through another conversion. And there are examples of people who have done so for companies and are doing so, can do so for the federal government as well.
Tony in Harrington Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning. Just wanted to ask your guests what he thought about making a priority about the advancement of healthcare technology, specifically electronic medical records, and moving from paper to electronic medical records.
So that question's for me, Brian?
Yeah, sure.
So, first of all, that's the one place where we are actually seeing that federal officials are starting to think about technology as not just a slice of the pie, but actually the pan that supports solutions in other places, and reducing costs on healthcare. One of the most major places it can be done is by digitizing the record keeping and making the system more efficient. And therefore, there's all kinds of other benefits that come, which is faster diagnosis and more accurate bringing together the right doctors with the patients who need their particular expertise happening digitally. That's clear. The other part of where technology can help with healthcare is in completely changing the way we go about determining whether someone needs help or not through, for example, wireless technologies. I can imagine 10 or 15 years from now that not only people will have pacemakers, but they will have simple monitors that allow their heartbeat to be monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, remotely. Hmm. And in the event of an emergency, or if their heart's not acting properly, they can get attention right away. There's life-saving opportunities related to the use of technology that are, you know, beyond our imagination today. But are within reach. Some of them are within reach within the next 10 or 15 years.
Now, you started an educational nonprofit called Mouse.org, which trains students in New York City to be more fluent in technology. We're 16th in the world. People in America are going to be shocked by this. I was shocked when I first realized this summer. We are 16th in the world in terms of broadband penetration and falling behind in terms of technological innovation. There are really 15 countries that have greater broadband penetration, that is, access to high-speed internet, than the United States?
That's not the only problem. The other problem is that the cost of broadband is so high that most working class people and their children can't afford the $500 or $600 a year to join the 21st century internet economy. They can't apply for college anymore without being online. So many resources are available online. So the digital divide is actually getting worse, not getting better, not because the schools aren't wired, but because the cost of getting online is beyond the reach of most Americans.
from our website. Someone writes, I'd like to see such a position also address and take a leadership role on the subject of privacy for consumers and for citizens, which will continue to emerge as a major issue. Someone writes, if the old government websites can't even accommodate YouTube videos, change.gov has already embedded YouTube videos. That's the Obama transition site. And so this person writes, so I guess with Obama, the rule that you started in the program will change. In other words, that YouTube videos will get in there and technological change is really on the way. Bear in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I was involved with the Obama campaign and actually started a PAC called Music for Democracy. And I saw what my.barackobama.com really did to revolutionize the way in which social networks interact in terms of people in the campaign being able to actually have a voice. So when FISA was passed, and a lot of us were totally against FISA, that's actually, I think, still the second biggest group on myBarackObama.com. Obama supporters who were against him supporting FISA. What role do you see social networks playing in the new administration?
Well, first of all, it would be terrific if we could just take the community that was on myBarackObama.com and just boot it over to the White House. And there's some rules that prevent that from happening because that's really a campaign site. So it's anticipated that the Obama campaign will build a similar type of community site, social networking site, for citizens to be able to engage with the president directly and to connect with each other, which is, I think, the more important part of it, because people can then form groups, form their own lobbying in effect associations, and petition the president, just like the FISA people did, to the point where, if you remember, Barack Obama actually responded to them, and they didn't get him to change his vote, but they felt that they had their voices heard, and that's probably the most important part of what this technology can provide, which is allowing citizens the opportunity to make sure their voices are heard, no longer relying on lobbyists or special interests that have more money or more access, but to actually go direct to the president, and this will now spread to Congress and senators, because any congressman or senator that doesn't start to think about applying the same communication techniques to their own constituency won't get reelected in 8 or 12 years.
So I wonder how big either of you, and Bear, stay with us for a minute on this, since you founded that PAC. The implications of this could be vast. I mean, David Carr suggested in the New York Times last Sunday that Obama could actually speed up the demise of the Democratic Party by cutting out the middleman, meaning the political party, as he gets suggestions directly from the public through things like change.gov. Andrew, do you think that's that's a realistic scenario?
Well, I think there's a role for the party to some degree, but obviously what we've witnessed in the last 2 to 4 years is that the Democratic Party's own rank and file organized themselves to elect their president because the party itself had failed to keep up with the Republicans in the use of new information technologies, databases, and techniques to get out the vote. And so, yes, there is now a new infrastructure, and it's going to be a challenge for the Democratic Party to maintain parity with citizens who are organizing themselves faster and better and cheaply, without having to do fundraisers with rubber chickens. to raise money.
To keep up with social entrepreneurs like you, Bear, what do you think about that? You ready to say good riddance to the Democratic Party?
Well, it's when you add the third dimension, which is the power of pop culture, whether that be musicians or celebrities, and the ability to really jump. If you look at what Lawrence Lessig is doing with Creative Commons and all this, we are seeing a total revolution in terms of cutting out the middleman. And if you check out on musicfordemocracy.org, what we've done is literally trying to, it's not about Democrats, it's about the progressive movement. And there are so many small organizations doing amazing things. And the goal is long-term. It's about really making government about a lot more direct democracy, using these tools to change our world and empower our generation. I'm 23. It's a really exciting time to be alive.
Bear, thanks a lot. You may be interested that Lawrence Lessig will be here as a guest next Tuesday, so everybody might want to know that. And we'll end with a shout-out to you, Andrew, from Craig of Craigslist, who just posted on our site. Craig Newmark writes, hey, Andrew's very savvy regarding tech and politics, and I rely on him for advice.
That's very nice to hear. And he's a great, very important voice for democracy and for citizen participation, and also a member of the board of the Sunlight Foundation, which many people, if they don't know about it, should, which is working hard to bring data from the federal government into the hands of the public so they can see what their elected leaders are doing.
And we're glad Craig Newmark is posting on WNYC.org. And Andrew, I'll ask you one other thing out the door. It's a politics question. In 2005, you ran in the Democratic primary for New York City public advocate against Betsy Gottbaum. Now that we're coming to a city election year again next year, any plans for anything like that, or have you moved on?
Well, my focus is now more on federal issues and trying to help improve the environment for technology to improve democracy around the country as opposed to in New York. But, you know, when I ran for public advocate, one of the problems was that I people knew me as the Wi-Fi guy, but they didn't quite understand that what I was really trying to do was build a network of public advocates, because I believe there are tens of thousands of them in New York who actually volunteer in schools or clean up parks or do other kinds of civic work, join community boards, and there are community organizers, in effect, and that the role of the public advocate shouldn't be one person sitting in City Hall, but rather a person who actually knows how to tap into a social network of public advocates who can come together on given issues and have their voices heard and to affect change. And maybe now that people understand what the Obama campaign has done, the next people running for public advocate might be able to reinvent the office on that model, and I'm hopeful for that.
All right. Andrew Roche, founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, co-founder of Tech President, Sunlight Foundation. Always good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me again.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, all these cuts announced at the Star Ledger. Old media. What might those cuts mean for democracy in New Jersey? And from Willits Point to Atlantic Yards, what will the financial crisis mean for development around New York? Will we see de-gentrification? Stay tuned.